Well, welcome, folks. We'll get started. But in the meantime, if you can take a look at this poll and just pick your answers, and we will share and get folks started at 5:30 promptly. But that's more minutes and we will get started, but do the poll for those who are just joining in, and we'll get going. Jennifer, you said you don't see a poll.
Nope.
Do others see a poll on their screen?
Let me see if I can press this relaunch button.
Okay.
21.
There it is.
Okay. Sorry about that. Thank you, Jennifer, for telling us, telling me that you didn't see the poll.
Mm-hmm. 22 on now. 22 participants right now.
We have more participants than people who've answered the poll, so I'll give it another minute and we'll get started. Okay, why don't we get started? I'll start with sharing the results. So most of the people here have attended a PACE talk, so welcome back. Some of you are new, so welcome, and we'll tell you what PACE talks are about. I'm glad that 75% of folks have seen a physician or a nurse practitioner in the last 2 years, because we hear all kinds of things, but that is excellent for Northumberland, that 75% of people have seen a doctor for preventive care. And 60% of you believe that your cancer screening is up to date, 13% think no, and 27% don't know. So we will certainly cover that on how to get back if you are in the 40% of you don't know, or your screening is not up to date. So I will start with introducing PACE talks for those who are new. PACE talks are literally community-facing talks where, you know, people from the community are invited to attend. People who give a talk are pure volunteers. They take their own time. They are thought leaders or experts in this field that is chosen. The topics are chosen by a small group of people, roughly six folks, which includes patients, which include myself, the folks from the foundation like Jen Gilmer, Jennifer Gillard from the hospital. This is a, and we do that once a year, and we also get input from you towards the end of the talk, what you would like to hear. The other feature of PACE Talks is this is a collaboration between Northumberland Hills Hospital, the NHH Foundation, the Northumberland Family Health Team, IMCARE, Port Hope Community Health Center, and Loyalist College. And there's no sponsorship, there's no money exchange, the speakers are not paid, and you can't sponsor anything in this event. So it is to maintain purity. The two things we don't talk about in this, in PACE Talks is government policies, politics, or anything that is like, you know, sort of that we are not going to solve that here. So that is what we don't talk about. So today's speaker is, let me spotlight him, is Dr. Wang Zi. Dr. Wang Zi is one of our family physicians from the Northumberland Family Health Team with an office in Coburg. He is a stellar physician who got recruited over 7 years, right? Wang, you've been here 7 years? Yep, 7 years ago. And he has played a very active role both in the community as well as at the hospital. He sees patients, so he's one of those docs who will come to the hospital, take care of his patients. He will go to long-term care. He will go to the post-acute unit. So he sees folks everywhere and has a good pulse. He's well-respected in the community of not just the patient, but the medical staff. He also is fairly computer savvy and is helping us with the transition as the hospital transitions to its latest and greatest information system. And he has agreed to volunteer his time to cover the topic of wellness and preventive care, and especially how to get back, because there was enough of a concern that preventive care may have been sidelined during the pandemic. We have been thinking about when would be the right time to do this talk, and I think this is the right time, though we had tried it in January, and then we said because of Omicron, we moved it to March. So, Wang, the floor is yours, and take it away.
Great. Thank you, Mukesh, for that introduction, and welcome everyone to this PACE Talks. It's my first time here for PACE Talks. Welcome everyone back who's attended before, and welcome to our newcomers as well. Give me a moment as I'm going to share my slides here. Here we go. Dr. Bhargava, can you confirm you can see my slides here? Very good. So the topic today is shifting our focus back to prevention and wellness. Or when I was thinking about this talk, actually, in the next 30 minutes or so, I'm going to talk about the things that I talk about in 30 minutes of the preventative health exam with my patients at the office. We cover many of these topics, and we're going to start by talking about some of these topics on prevention and wellness. So I have no disclosures, no conflict of interest, and no relationships with financial interest. So some of our objectives for this talk is to discuss preventative health measures. And as Mukesh had alluded to, we think that there may be some preventative health measures which have been sidelined during the pandemic. So I'd be actually highlighting those preventative care measures that need your doctor's intervention, but also some of those that you can do yourself. Because as things begin to open up, as you're trying to book appointments with your doctor, there'll be lots of individuals who are doing the same thing as you. And so so it may be challenging. So there are a few things that you can do yourself. And I've highlighted these things with that yellow background, and I'll point these out as we're going along. We'll be talking about screening measures, lifestyle measures, and then we're going to try to get comfortable with the fact that more is not always better, and sometimes more is worse. And what we don't really kind of talk about in this talk is that, which I will highlight as well, is that you do need to see your own doctor to get care that is catered to you, because much of this talk might assume that you don't have any chronic medical conditions. But if you do have chronic medical conditions, it's important to see your doctor for ongoing management for those conditions as well. For example, diabetes, hypertension. If you haven't seen your doctor in the last few months to a year, it's time to get in and see your doctor to follow up on these conditions. Well, let's get started here. So first thing, I've pulled up a couple of things in the media here. This is from February 4th this year. This is from CTV News. And the headline is, cancer detection has fallen dramatically during the pandemic, worrying experts. So next is, this is actually, I just pulled in today. This was from a week ago. This is CBC News, time for a regular checkup. Here's what doctors say you should ask about. So if you search up this topic actually online, it actually includes quite a few different things that we're going to be talking about today. So the first thing I wanted to go over was disease screening in average risk individuals. And I do highlight the term average risk individuals. And there are many variations. There are many other forms of screening in those at higher risk. So I'll point these out as we're going along. First, if we're talking about screening, we should get a good idea of what screening means. Screening is the detection of disease in an early stage, so prior to symptom onset. And often the test is not necessarily a definitive test. They may lead to other tests. A negative test for a screening test is very reassuring. Meanwhile, a positive test often requires some type of confirmation, whether it be biopsy, further imaging, or some other form of confirmatory test. And effective screening is actually where early detection of the disease does make a difference in the treatment outcome. And later we'll be talking about things we don't screen for because there's no effective screening. Some of the things we'll be talking about for screening would be cancer screening, metabolic disease screening, vascular disease screening, infectious disease screening. But most of all, like I mentioned before, it's important to talk to your doctor or nurse practitioner to make sure that what you're being screened for is right for you and for your risk level as well. So let's get started on the screening portion. First item is up is colon cancer screening in average risk individuals. And so the in the poll, 60% of you said you're up to date for your screening. One of the things that you can do as an exercise here is that you can get a pen and a piece of paper. And as we're going along, you can write down what tests you're actually might be due for, or you need to check in with your doctor to see if you're due for this or not. So feel free to write things down as we go along and things to inquire for your doctor. So for colon cancer screening, the age group here is 50 to 74. It's done every 2 years using the fecal immunohistochemistry test. And there's a picture of the test that is sent to you in the mail when your doctor requests it. I've highlighted the in the yellow text is that if you don't have a doctor or nurse practitioner, you can actually call this number at Telehealth Ontario to request this FIT, it's an abbreviated FIT, this FIT test. For some of you who have done the FOBT test, fecal occult blood test, where you had to do 3 samples, this is actually a much simpler test. It's a single sample, and so you don't need to collect it over the course of 3 days. And it's easy to collect, and you send it. You send it in the mail to the lab, and they detect it here. It's quite small in here. At the bottom left on the envelope, it says exempt human specimen. So I guess we're not supposed to send poop regularly in the mail. So so this is exempt. The one thing is that, again, touching on the fact that we're talking about screening, is that if you have symptoms, like, for example, if you have any form of bleeding from your gastrointestinal tract, seeing blood in the stool, such, then we're no longer talking about screening. That's symptomatic evaluation, and something like that requires a colonoscopy. And actually, the this test can be positive because it detects blood, but occasionally it can actually be negative because the test sometimes, if you don't have blood in your stool on that day that you actually do the test, it can be negative, and it can be falsely reassuring that way. So just to emphasize that we're still talking about screening here. Next item is actually breast cancer screening in average of risk individuals. And again, the age group here is 50 to 74 for women. It's done every 2 years. It's done through a mammogram. And I've listed the numbers here that you can call to find a screening center near you. Of course, NHH is our local screening center. However, we know that Port Hope Blue Water Imaging is actually also a screening center as well. If you're not sure if you are due for screening or not, and you've last had your mammogram done at NHH, you can call the number listed there, 905-377-7795, and actually inquire whether you are due for screening. Again, this doesn't actually need your doctor or nurse practitioner involved. You can just call and book the appointment yourself. Next is cervical cancer screening, again, in average risk individuals. And this is for women aged 21 to 65, although new guidelines will likely be coming out to increase that age to between 25 to 69 due to the advent of HPV vaccination among grade 8 girls. And this is done every 3 years, and it's done through a pap smear. And I do have patients sometimes tell me that they're on their menstrual cycle, so they can't do their pap smear. That was actually an old contraindication that's not actually true anymore. You can get a pap smear at any time, regardless of your menstrual cycle. Now we're getting into a couple of things that might be a bit newer. One thing is lung cancer screening. So this specifically applies to smokers. And it's for individuals aged 55 to 74. And the current criteria for lung cancer screening is that you are either currently smoking or you've quit within the last 15 years. And you've got a 30-pack year smoking history or more. A pack year is where you smoke a pack of cigarettes every day for the entire year. A pack year is also if you smoked half a pack of cigarettes every day for 2 years, and that's equivalent to a pack year. And the test of choice here is a CAT scan, a CT scan of your chest done yearly for 3 years. The current Ontario is currently piloting a program, and in a similar way to the Ontario Breast Screening Program, is a full-fledged program. Ontario is currently piloting a program for lung cancer screening, but some doctors are ordering this on a routine basis. Ontario has previously said, don't do lung cancer screening in the absence of a program offered by Ontario, but some doctors are using the current guidelines and doing this screening. So if you're eligible for this, you can ask your doctor about it. One other thing is abdominal aortic aneurysm screening. And actually for this talk, I had to ask some of my colleagues, do you do abdominal aortic aneurysm screening? Because there's actually a large variation in practice on this. The Canadian guidelines say that it's for men age 65 to 80. The reason that they specified men is that men are at greater risk, more than twice the risk of women for aortic aneurysms. However, some publications do suggest that women are screened as well, but this is, I'm giving you the most evidence-based guidelines here. And the test is a single one-time ultrasound of the abdomen at some time between the age of 65 to 80. And these are the Canadian guidelines. And the Canadian guidelines came into place about 2017. I actually use the American guidelines because they've existed for a longer, and their guideline is for men 65 to 75 who have a greater risk factor, which is that they have ever smoked, or if they have a family history of this aneurysm. And when I asked my colleagues, they had a variation in their practice. Some use the Canadian guidelines, some use the American guidelines, and some basically have this discussion with their patient that about screening, whether it's worthwhile or not, because screening can lead to more tests. Screening, a positive screen, can lead to further follow-up and can lead to surgery, which can be have large impacts as well. So they kind of have that discussion before going into screening for everyone. So there are some variation to practice, and it's worthwhile asking your doctor if you're eligible for this and if it's a good idea for you. Osteoporosis screening, and this is for age 65 plus, and it's both men and women. And we know that traditionally, many more bone density tests, bone mineral density, which is a test of choice, are actually ordered for women and not many for men. And we know that statistic. But actually, the current guidelines say that if you're over 65, whether you're a man or a woman, you should be getting osteoporosis screening. And this is done every 1 to 5 years and depends on level of risk from your first bone density scan. So you should talk to your doctor about this, though, because several individuals are actually eligible for screening at less than 65. And that includes certain risk factors, some of the common ones I've listed, but there are actually quite a few other risk factors here. So one is called what in the medical community we call fragility fracture. What that is a fracture falling from standing height. So this is a slip on the ice. We're still in the middle of winter. A slip on the ice where you fractured your wrist, or if you fractured your hip, or if your doctor ever told you that you have a vertebral compression fracture. And those are all risk factors for osteoporosis, and those require bone density screening even at age less than 65. Often it starts at age 50 in that case. And if you have any illness where you have long-term steroid use, or if you actually weigh less than 60 kilograms. And so we see here actually having a higher weight is more protective against osteoporosis, and that we have a short slide on weight later on here as well. So these are some risk factors, which if you're less than 65, you may be eligible. Again, important to speak to your doctor about it. Routine blood work. This is often offered for individuals age 40 plus. It can, based on guidelines, can actually be done every about 3 to 5 years in average risk individuals. But for practicality's sake, it's often checked on a yearly basis. And there are certain risk factors where you would need to get this checked on a yearly basis as well. In general, we actually check for diabetes and high cholesterol. We often do check for kidney function as well, for practicality's sake too. And based on actually current guidelines, again, this varies between American and Canadian guidelines. The American guidelines will actually say that you should have a one-time screen for hepatitis C if you're 18 or older. Now, the Canadian guidelines say that if you have certain risk factors, you should get a one-time screen for hepatitis C. That could be previous blood transfusion, previous needle stick injury, whether accidental or intentional. So there are certain risk factors. So it's something, this is one of the things that you can ask your doctor about: should I be screened for hepatitis C? And some individuals with hepatitis C are actually asymptomatic. And certainly I know of a case that I've picked up in my own practice that was asymptomatic. It was done through screening. And now there's actually a cure for hepatitis C. It's a few weeks of antiviral medications. And so that's why it's now important for screening, because now there is a cure for it. And we know that I believe for in Canada, the statistics is that for our almost 40 million people population, there's about 400,000 people with hepatitis C. And between a quarter to a half, I believe, actually don't know that they have the illness. So it's reasonable to ask your doctor in regards to that. Vaccinations, of course, the vaccinations, COVID vaccinations have been a very hot topic in the last year. But there are many other vaccinations that we need to talk about, and they're very effective for preventing disease. Tetanus vaccination is done on every 10-year basis. Hopefully you've still got those yellow cards that tell you when your last tetanus shot was. Pneumonia vaccination. So pneumonia vaccination, there's two vaccines for pneumonia that are recommended. One is Prevnar, Prevnar 13, and followed 8 weeks later by Pneumovax. Unfortunately, Prevnar, even though it's recommended by NACI, the National Council on Immunization, it's not actually covered by OHIP. And so I checked in with the pharmacy. It costs about $140 to $150. If you have a drug coverage plan, often it does cover the majority of it. So it's not cheap, but it is effective. It covers 13 strains of pneumococcal pneumonia. The Pneumovax covers 23 other strains of pneumococcal pneumonia, which is why both are actually recommended. Both are protective against this pneumococcal bacterial pneumonia. Shingles vaccine. The Shingrix vaccine is recommended for anyone age 50 plus. The current statistic is actually that the lifetime risk of getting shingles is about 30%, sometimes as high as 40%. So I usually tell my patients that in a husband and wife pair or in a couple, the risk of actually one of you getting shingles is very high. So that's why I do recommend it. And the Shingrix vaccine is actually 90 to 95% effective at protecting against shingles lifelong. It's a series of two vaccines. It's, again, not covered by OHIP unless you're between 65 to 70. A single vaccination costs just over $150. It's about $170. So both vaccines will actually run you up about $300 to $350. Again, quite expensive. But if you do wait till between age 65 to 70, then OHIP does cover it for you. If you had the previous Zostavax vaccine, which is that single dose vaccine that you may have received, and you had to run to your doctor's office within 30 minutes or it expires, if you got that one, and then you are actually supposed to get the Shingrix as well. And as long as it's been more than a year, which we haven't used Zostavax for 2 to 3 years now, then you're eligible for Shingrix, because Zostavax immunity wanes after about 5 to 10 years. And of course, the flu vaccine, I've highlighted again in yellow because you can get this at the pharmacy on a yearly basis. HPV vaccine is actually recommended up until age 45. Grade 8 boys and girls are actually getting this in school, but there is a segment of the population who would not have received this because they were not in grade 8 when they started offering this. And it's only starting to be offered to grade 8s in the last couple of years for boys. And of course, as things are opening up, many of us are planning travel. It's important to talk to your doctor about vaccinations prior to travel as well. So don't forget about those. So getting into the topic of actually some things that we don't screen for, and again, I put an average risk individuals, and sometimes we do screen for it. So and some of these may be a little bit more controversial, but actually, so for example, for prostate cancer in men, the current recommendation now is actually no routine screening. 10 years ago, we screened almost all men, but actually in several years ago, guidelines came out and the European societies, the US and Canada are in agreement, no routine prostate cancer screening for men. And why is that? Because the test that we have, this prostate-specific antigen, the PSA test, which is a blood test, is notoriously inaccurate for screening. It's great for following disease. So if you had prostate cancer, to follow for recurrence, or if you have it to follow for the degree of disease, but it's not great for screening. Later I'll share a resource that you can find, and you can actually use it to use something they call the 1,000 person tool, which is the 1,000 person tool for prostate cancer screening in men. I couldn't put it up here because it was too small, but it says that for 1,000 men who do screening with the PSA for prostate cancer, one man's life will be saved, which is still significant, right? One in 1,000, it's still significant. However, about 33 of these men, well, first there would be about 100 who have positive tests, and 33 of these men, they will undergo some tests that may have significant side effects. So whether they end up getting a biopsy or they end up getting a prostate actually removed, and they may suffer from things like incontinence, erectile dysfunction, chronic pain, sometimes hospitalization or bleeding because of it. So 33 men will actually suffer some type of effects from the various testing that you go through, which is quite significant as well. And so that's why most societies now have suggested no routine screening, but do talk to your male patient about it. And so that's what I do at my office. I talk to my patients about, so, and I use that 1,000 person tool in the same way that I've explained to you now, that do you want to do screening if that's the case, and then we make a shared decision about whether to do that screening or not. And again, for screening, actually, it's not covered. It costs about $30 at the lab. The other thing is that, again, this is we're still talking about screening. So if you have symptoms of your prostate, you should actually get it, your prostate checked by your doctor through a physical exam. So symptoms may be difficulty starting urination, getting up at night more than twice to urinate. If you finish urinating and then 5 minutes later you have to go again, those are sometimes symptoms of enlarged prostate, and those should be actually checked through your doctor through a physical exam, and they can determine whether a PSA is appropriate for you or not. Some of the things we don't routinely screen for is thyroid disease, and we don't routinely screen for a cognitive impairment. Again, the reasoning behind cognitive impairment is that often individuals will come and or the family member will identify that. And the other thing is that there's currently actually no effective medication or a specific treatment for early cognitive impairment. And so that's why we don't end up screening for it. But if there were actual medications where if you caught cognitive impairment early, and that may be coming down this recent research pipeline, then this may be actually something we may screen for in the future. And there's many other things that we actually don't end up screening for, but I just give you a few examples and the reason behind why we don't screen for these things. So what about this annual physical? And I'm going to give you a statement here from the Canadian College for Family Physicians. And they say, we recommend that primary care practitioners adopt periodic prevention health visits instead of providing annual physical examinations for the delivery of preventive services. What that kind of says is that the gist of it is that your doctor putting their stethoscope on your chest or putting their hands on your abdomen to feel around doesn't make you healthier. And the evidence said there's no evidence to show that that actually makes you healthier. And sometimes when you're, if you have, let's say, a 15 to 30 minute visit with your doctor for this physical, by doing these physical examination maneuvers, maybe you actually don't have time to talk about something else, which is higher impact. Now and again, this is for asymptomatic individuals. If you have any form of symptoms, then the physical examination certainly is a key to achieving some diagnoses. So again, this is for kind of asymptomatic, this annual physical. So we're actually not typically doing these annual physicals, but we call them preventive health visits. It's still important to come see your doctor every 1 to 2 years. And one of the things I lied to you a bit, it is important for your doctor to do one thing, which is part of the physical, which is to measure your blood pressure. And the blood pressure target is less than 135 over 85. And again, I've highlighted this in yellow because this is something you can do yourself at home. And I want to actually go take a minute to go over this, because lots of us have blood pressure cuffs at home, but we want to make sure that we're doing it according to the guidelines and properly. So this is how to measure your blood pressure at home. So first, don't exercise, smoke, or drink for 30 minutes prior to measuring your blood pressure. Wear a short-sleeved shirt that you can roll up. Don't do it over a sweater or a thick shirt. Sit upright in a dining chair, so don't sit on your couch or on your lazy boy chair. Sit in a quiet space, legs uncrossed, your feet flat. You're supposed to wait 5 minutes, but I don't think any of my patients wait 5 minutes, so I just say wait a couple of minutes. Support your arm on the table, and then you're supposed to measure your blood pressure 3 times, 1 minute apart. The first reading tends to be the highest and tends to be a little bit inaccurate most of the time, because most of us can't really wait 5 minutes. So you actually are supposed to drop the first reading and average the last two, and that's your blood pressure for that sitting. You repeat the process twice a day for a week, and then at the end of the week, you'll have 7 days or 14 sets of readings. And if all average of all those readings is less than 135 over 85, then you're all good. If it is higher than that, then you should be speaking to your doctor about your blood pressure. Okay. So next we'll actually get on to a few things which are lifestyle modification for preventative health. And I've highlighted all these in yellow because all these are things that you can look at yourself, you can do some research yourself, and you can implement yourself as well. And actually, we talked a lot about all these screening tests, cancer screening, for example. I'll just kind of give you an example of the magnitude of benefit. So for example, the colon cancer screening test, that FIT test, it takes between 350 to 700 individuals who do that test where you kind of, where you're saving a life, right? Which is, again, very significant, we're talking about doing, 700 tests to save a life. But actually, if you look at smoking cessation, if you take an average risk individual, let's say age 65, and they smoke, their risk of having some type of a heart attack or heart event is about is about 20% actually over the next 10 years. And if you actually quit smoking, your risk goes down to 10%. And so if you actually look at quitting smoking, only about 10 people need to quit smoking to actually prevent that heart attack. We're only talking about heart attacks. We're not talking about cancer prevention and other health prevention like COPD prevention as well. So some of these actually have very large impacts, including this Mediterranean diet and physical activity. They have very large impacts in regards to your health. So we'll spend a bit of time talking about these four things. So the first thing is smoking cessation. I realize this being a paced talk, probably the audience is somewhat self-selected in those who quite focus on their health, and perhaps none of you actually smoke. But perhaps the takeaway is that some information for you, as well as for family members and friends to share this information with them. So smoking cessation results in the 40 to 50% reduction in cardiovascular disease, and that cardiovascular risk is actually reversed 5 to 10 years after you quit smoking. But the challenge is actually it's a very difficult task. And the long-term quit rate sits about 8%, and that's without medication. The medications actually work. Nicotine replacement, I should have highlighted this in yellow, which is something you can do yourself. You can buy over the counter. You're 1.6 times more likely to quit bupropion, which is Zyban, and varenicline, which is Champix. With Champix, you're actually 2.2 times more likely to quit, and it results in up to a 31% long-term quit rate. I always work with my patients to see what they're open to, because I often have heard certain stories about Champix or Zyban or even nicotine patch, and they tend to favor one or the other, because it's very important for individuals to have that full buy-in and commitment to what they are doing for smoking cessation. Next item on the list is this Mediterranean diet. And the Mediterranean diet is actually results in about 25 to 30% reduction in cardiovascular risk. And what is the Mediterranean diet actually? It's typically, I explain it as a diet that's fairly high in fruits and vegetables, choosing whole grains, choosing milk and water as your drink of choice, and lower in the red meats, lower in salt as well. So I've taken some of these images from the Alberta Health Services guidelines for a Mediterranean diet and how to adhere to it. And so vegetables, you see that there's 5 or more servings a day, fruit, 3 or more servings a day, whole grains, 5 to 6 servings every day, milk and alternative products, use of olive oil, nuts, seeds, olives, avocado. And then we have beans and lentils, fish and seafood as well. And then in terms of meat products, they recommend lean meat and less than 2 servings a day. One of the things is that certain meat products are not only high in fatty content, but also high in salts as well. I'll actually provide the link to this at the end of the presentation, and I'll provide the slides. And I believe this presentation will be recorded for you later as well. So this is that's the Mediterranean diet. And how do we achieve this, though? So Canada's food guide, you can actually see a picture of the Canada's food guide behind me. I'm in one of my examination rooms. Canada's food guide is actually a good way to look at how to achieve what's recommended in the Mediterranean diet. And that's that half of your plate is fruits and vegetables at, you know, lunch and dinner, and breakfast as well, if, depending on the size of your breakfast. And a quarter of your plate is grains, whole whole grains, and the other quarter of your plate is meat and protein foods. Because we know that to try to achieve that the 5 to 6 vegetables, 3 to 4 fruit servings per day, it's hard to just have them as snacks. You do have to include a large part in your everyday meals as well. So I do like this Canada's food guide, because it kind of tells you what your plate should look like. Physical activity. So many of us know that we're supposed to do physical activity. The recommended amount is 150 minutes each week. And actually, this is a minimum 10-minute bouts of activity. So you don't need to do 30 minutes at a time. If you couldn't tolerate it or you were too busy, you could do 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes in the evening if you wanted to. And it still works. It doesn't seem to work in less than 10-minute bouts, though. And the activity has to be moderate, so it could be brisk walking, water aerobics, cycling. I usually say that if it's something that gets your heart rate up a little bit, then it's probably moderate intensity activity. If you actually do vigorous activity, something such as running, you actually only need about half the amount, which is 75 minutes each week. And physical activity actually will reduce in your cardiovascular risk to a similar amount as the Mediterranean diet, which is about 25 to 30% in terms of reduction. If you combine them both together, they do add together in terms of really reducing your risk. Next is following the low-risk alcohol intake guidelines. The current Canadian guidelines say that for men, you can have up to 15 alcoholic drinks per week, which is up to 3 per day. And for women, it's up to 10 drinks per week, which is up to 2 per day. I've copied an image from the Canadian guidelines, so we know how much alcohol is in one standard drink. One thing I would actually like to highlight is a standard bottle of wine. It's 750 milliliters and it has just slightly over 5 standard drinks in it. I hear sometimes is that a couple, a man, woman, husband and wife pair, share a bottle of wine every night. And actually, if you drink 7 bottles of wine in a week, one of you is actually going over the low-risk alcohol intake guidelines. So you do need to pay attention to that because in 7 bottles, there's actually 35 drinks. And so the current maximum, if a man and woman are added together, is actually 25. So I just wanted to highlight that as well. So how do we actually achieve some of these lifestyle modifications? We usually talk about them a lot. And so how do we actually achieve them? So we like to use something called SMART goals. And you may very well have heard of them before, even used them before. Specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time bound. So if we look at it, first, this non-specific goal, I want to get healthier. So it's not specific. We don't really know what we're going to do to get healthier, but we have some idea. But how do we get this into a SMART goal? So we have to be specific. We want to exercise. And so how are we going to exercise? How are we going to measure that? So I'm going to walk for 30 minutes per day for 3 times a week. So assuming, let's say, you're inactive, sedentary, this is your goal. Notice I haven't put 30 minutes a day for 5 times a week, because I want you to start where you feel like you can achieve it. So whether it be 3 times a day, maybe it's just once a day, maybe it's 10 minutes once a day. That's still a goal, and that's still something that you can measure. Next item is achievable. And again, that's something that you know that you may be able to achieve. To make sure that you're actually seeing how you're going to achieve it. So I'm going to walk at 7 p.m. after dinner. I'm going to use a treadmill because it's the winter. I don't want to slip out there. And I'm going to do on Tuesday, Thursdays, and Saturdays. So, and then make sure that it's relevant. And as we talked about before, it does help reduce your cardiovascular risk. So it is important. And it's time bound. So I'm going to start April 1st. I'm going to look at it again on May 1st to see if I'm achieving my goal and revisit it. So this type of SMART goals, some doctors actually do give a prescription and actually talk to their patient about it and actually write down the SMART goal for them to try to achieve. And I do have a short slide about weight loss here, because weight loss is very socially important to everyone, but actually medically, in the absence of other disease like hypertension or diabetes or some other illnesses, weight loss is actually not that important compared to the lifestyle interventions. So smoking cessation, Mediterranean diet, physical activity, and following low-risk alcohol intake guidelines, the benefits that I talk about are there whether or not you lose weight or not. Because I do, in my practice, recommend this Mediterranean diet, physical activity, and some patients are able to achieve a good amount of activity after 3 months, but then they notice that they're not losing any weight, they're disappointed, and then they quit. And so I never prescribe weight loss in the absence of other illness, because guidance on diet, physical activity actually produce these benefits without weight loss. And as we mentioned earlier, having a slightly higher weight is actually protective against osteoporosis. So it may be some protective factors there. So that's why I don't usually emphasize weight loss in my visits. And so we're just coming towards the end of the presentation here. Here are some resources here. So CanadianTaskForce.ca, so there are some guidelines meant for medical professionals, but if you actually see what I highlighted here in tools and resources and under screening tools, and I've selected colon cancer here, there's actually a patient frequently asked questions guide. You can see that at the bottom. This is where I was talking about for prostate cancer screening. There's the 1,000 person tool to help you make a decision. So they have topics on all the different things that we do screen for and don't screen for that I mentioned. And you can actually go there and look at some additional information. There's information targeted towards healthcare professionals as well as information targeted towards patients as well. And this is the handout on the Mediterranean style of eating that I had mentioned earlier. It's a long link, so I'll provide the slide later so that you can access it directly. And for exercise, there's some guidance there on this Canadian Society for Exercise guidelines here. Yeah. And of course, there are some other topics that are covered by the other PACE talks, and I do invite you to watch and look at them. One is one by my colleague, Dr. Dan Ricciuto, about don't be a vector, how to stop spreading infections. He talks about hand hygiene and other things. And as well, we didn't really get into the effect of mental health on preventative health, which is very important here. And I'll highlight a couple of previous talks self-care and wellness science of mindfulness, which were given in the last 3 years. And they're available on the PACE Talks website for you to view. And the last thing is that make sure you remember to visit your doctor for wellness advice tailored to you. I've given you kind of the routine guidelines that I go over for my preventative health exams, but you often will have advice quite tailored to you as well. Good. And that's the end of the formal presentation. And thanks very much for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you, Wang. That was wonderful. We will get into some of the questions that have been posted, some others. I must say, I did the exercise that you asked, that as I'm listening to your presentation, I'm looking at my own things. What have I missed in 2 years? And I picked up 3 things that I need to do on my list and get to my doctor and say, okay, please, can we get back into wellness? So thank you for that thing. So let's start with the chat questions. feel free to get on camera, feel free to raise. And this is all friends, colleagues, you know, we know each other. So no reason not to get on. So let's see. First question was from Selena. Selena said, is there breast cancer screening for men?
So for average risk individuals, there's no breast cancer screening for men. However, if a man actually has several first degree relatives, so sisters, mom, who have breast cancer, they should speak with their family doctor about a high risk of breast cancer screening, because men can actually carry this BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene, which can make you prone to a very high risk of breast cancer. In the media, you probably were aware of Angelina Jolie having bilateral mastectomies because she carried this gene and it created a very high risk of breast cancer. And she elected to perform double mastectomies to prevent this. So if a man actually has several first degree relatives with breast cancer, they should speak to their doctor to analyze the their risk and whether they should have some form of screening.
Sure. Thank you. The second one is, as it relates to blood tests, apparently you need a requisition from a doctor. How do folks get it done if they don't have a physician?
So this is a challenge because it's purposefully done that one cannot get a blood test without a medical order from a physician or a nurse practitioner. Of course, we know that the ability to access walk-in clinics is quite limited. We don't want you to visit things like an emergency department for this type of thing. So you would actually have to access a walk-in type clinic to get a requisition. We do have a couple of virtual clinics in pharmacies now available. If you truly don't have a doctor, you can access care that way or visit one of the walk-in clinics closer to us, for example, Bowmanville Walk-in Clinic.
Okay, great. So there are some questions on vaccine, but Wang, you mentioned a lot of vaccines, and one of the vaccine was HPV vaccine. And traditionally, vaccines are meant to prevent infections. So you get a tetanus shot to prevent tetanus, you get a pneumonia shot to get pneumonia, but HPV vaccine is different. Can you share, because it seems to prevent cancer. So how does a vaccine prevent cancer?
Yeah, the HPV vaccine prevents, it's called Gardasil 9, prevents the 9 most common strains of HPV virus. So it does prevent infection, with the HPV virus. We know some of these viruses are the cause of cervical cancer. And we know that actually not only does it cause cervical cancer, it can cause other types of cancers, including anal cancer, as well as cancer in your throat and tonsils, because we know the HPV virus actually can infect all of these tissues. The HPV vaccine actually is meant to prevent infection with the HPV virus significantly reduce the risk of cancer. And actually is recommended for men, not just women, because initially it was used to prevent cervical cancer, but it's now indicated for men because of the things that I mentioned. Is actually men can get HPV and they can actually get tonsillar cancer or anal cancer or other forms of cancer related to HPV. And so it's recommended for both genders.
Thank you. So Jennifer, your question about OHIP and coverage and funding, I'm going to pass just because it is not something Wang and Dr. Z can solve. It is more of a funding and political.
It is an election year, so there might be a little bit more money and expansion right. of the age group there.
Right. So we physicians always say we should have more prevention dollars than none. The next one is from Bill. And Bill, I see you on, I saw you on the camera. You can ask the question. You have moderated pace, so.
Yeah, I think the question I had is quite often when you're doing or you're applying for insurance for travel, they ask about, have you had a medical in the last 12 to 18 months? This certainly doesn't help if you ask your doctor and he says, oh, we don't do it anymore. We just do it occasionally. What would you recommend or what do you do?
Yeah, the requirements of certain insurance companies are quite different. And actually, I assume maybe you're talking about travel insurance.
Right. Yeah.
But actually, for things even like life insurance, they will actually come and draw a bunch of your blood work, which is actually not indicated routinely, for example, liver function tests and such. But they use their own algorithms to determine the general risk level. If your insurance company is actually, if you had a physical in the last 18 months, you do have to specifically inquire of what they mean by physical. Is it just that you went into the office and got your blood pressure checked? And is that like a physical exam? Or do they mean a full head-to-toe physical, which we actually rarely do anymore? And what impact that actually has on your insurance application? Because we know that this annual physical is actually of limited value. The preventative health exam is actually of good value. And whether the preventative health exam actually counts as the physical, because that is what we're doing as the physical now.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think the next question is Susan Walsh.
Okay. See the question here.
Sorry, I froze. Did you already move on or can I still ask?
No, you can absolutely ask. You're the president and CEO of Northumberland Hills Hospital. Come on.
Well, I also like to take my turn. Dr. Z, thank you. Wonderful presentation. I wonder if you could comment on the body mass index. You talked about weight loss, weight not necessarily being a risk factor, but BMI has very specific parameters of what they consider to be morbidly obese. So I wonder if you could talk about the BMI.
Yeah, so the latest data, Canadian data, would suggest about 40 to 50% of the population is has a BMI over 25, which is overweight or obese. Is that going to be one of the things? Is that really that useful in terms of our everyday care? So the BMI and weight is important in individuals, particularly with diabetes and hypertension, because we know that even the 20 pound weight loss can actually really reduce your blood pressure, help management, and help diabetes. And I've seen this in many of my patients as well. But the use of the BMI, there's a lot of stigma tied to it. But again, it's now 40% of the population is greater overweight or obese, and whether that's a really truly a useful value. I actually, in my own practice, I have actually, in the last few years, I have never I don't talk about BMI with my patients. I've only mentioned BMI for those who are actually undergoing bariatric surgery, because there's a very specific BMI criteria for bariatric surgery. But I actually don't use the term BMI with my patients.
Right. Thank you. Jackie Gardner-Nix.
Hi, thanks for the presentation. There's research to show that no alcohol is advised, as even some can increase cancer risks. Can you comment on that?
Yeah. Thank you, Jackie. Then the current guidelines make a comment in regards to, we don't know what is a safe amount of alcohol to intake. And so, again, this is the Canadian guidelines are provide some general advice because they, I get the feeling that they do feel that if you told everyone to be a teetotaler, you know, abstain from alcohol altogether, then that would be a very difficult guideline to follow and may lose some credibility here. In my practice, I assess a person's risk and then I ask them the question, how important is alcohol to you? And if they say that it is very important, you know, this is what I always do and it's very important to me, then try not to push them too hard if they're following the current low risk intake guidelines. But if they say that it's not important at all to me, it's easy to give up, then I actually generally recommend for them to cut back or abstain from alcohol altogether. We know actually any amount of alcohol can significantly impact cognition. And as I mentioned, like we don't really screen for cognitive impairment. So those individuals who have early, very early cognitive impairment, you don't actually know who they are per se. But the alcohol can actually significantly impact that cognition as well. So it really is kind of based on that patient preference.
Okay. Great. Thank you. The other one is Carlos saying thank you. And Carlos, I must say, is one of the guys who has been coming from the first ever PACE talk held at, in the NHH boardroom. So thank you for your compliment, Carlos. Ronald Coleman, go ahead. You're on screen.
Okay, I had two questions. One of the first one may not be very material, but the second one bothers me. My first question was about your comment on 15 drinks per week. That sounded to me like a lot, and I was wondering, maybe I missed what you said, how do you measure the size of a drink in that context? The second question was, it looked like your slides stopped at age 65. Do you have any particular recommendations for people like me who are in their mid-80s or even older? Mm-hmm.
Those are great questions. Yeah.
Is that another subject?
I'll try to answer them briefly. Yes, 15 drinks is a lot. It's basically one 350 milliliter bottle of beer or a 5 ounce glass of wine or 1.5 ounces of alcohol. It is a lot. And that's why I had mentioned that I usually recommend individuals, particularly, for example, in your age group, 80 plus, that you mentioned, to significantly kind of cut back, cut down altogether, because really any amount of alcohol can cause some impairment, right? And impairment causes other things like cognitive impairment, falls, and some of these other things that affect a particular 80 or 90 plus. So that is a lot. And so during my interviews with, you know, with patients, I don't say, you're not drinking any alcohol. You know, you can drink two a day, right? You should be drinking. So I don't do that. I just inquire and say, see how, if they're interested in cutting back or not. And then
less is better.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other item was in regards to for screening for 80 plus. And so there is actually a lack of evidence for the screening, the benefits of screening for 80 plus. And it does generally cut off at around age 74. Part of it is that not as many studies, and part of it is actually they actually didn't show benefit in some of the studies. So I'll give you an example. For example, for colorectal cancer, you can use the FIT test, the stool sample test, up until age 85. And sometimes I do actually do that for my individuals over age 70, 74. So if you come into my office, you're 76, and you do a cartwheel into my office, I'm going to give you a FIT test because you're very fit. And so fit for the FIT test, I'd say. So there is kind of clinician discretion for some of these screening. But what we also know is that the diet, exercise, smoking cessation, low risk alcohol works regardless of your age. So all of these lifestyle modifications, which actually have the highest impact and actually work regardless of age.
Thank you.
Thank you. No, this is a tough one, Ronald, about age and when do you stop doing things? And everybody with the same age may not have the same life expectancy based on their comorbidities. So often it is a very personalized decision rather than a generalized decision. So that is what Vang is saying, and that is what we practically do. Let's see, Jennifer Darrell. Jennifer, I can ask the question on your behalf. Sure. So I take it there's no medical basis for age group for a free shingles shot. It is not a case that the group being more prone to shingles. Do you get more prone to shingles as you get older?
You do have an increased risk to shingles as you get older, and we often see shingles in the time of physical or mental stress reappear. So it's recommended for age 50, and the risk does increase as you get older. There's no real medical basis for that age group. It's just a cost issue.
Okay, great. So I'll ask a few things that come to my mind. But in the meantime, people, if you can put any suggestions for future talks as Art has put in the chat box, that would be great. So here are my rapid fire questions, Vang. You ready for it?
Sure.
Okay. Vitamins and supplements. What should one take? Because a lot of folks take some. What would you suggest? Where is the evidence?
Yeah, vitamin D is generally good to take. The evidence is actually not that great surrounding just supplementing everyone with vitamin D. Using the Osteoporosis Canada, osteoporosis.ca calcium calculator is important to see if you take enough calcium, to see if you need supplements or not. Aside from that, multivitamins, not much evidence there. Vitamin B12, other vitamins, not much evidence there. So my vitamin D is a reasonable thing to take.
So should you get your vitamin D level checked?
You can. So if you have osteoporosis, you should get your vitamin D level checked. It is recommended on the guidelines and can help guide therapy. But we know that particularly during Canadian winter, as many individuals are deficient in vitamin D, and whether that actually taking vitamin D, I may be deficient in vitamin D, whether me taking vitamin D is actually beneficial or not, probably not. There's probably no evidence for that. So not everybody, but if you have osteoporosis, get it checked.
Okay, great. Thank you. Dark chocolate. People say dark chocolate has medicinal value. Should we be eating dark chocolate?
Mm-hmm. I'm not too sure about that, actually. I haven't recommended it to my patients before. Chocolate itself has some other effects, of course.
Okay. Tea, coffee, green teas, tea, chamomile tea. There's a lot of industry around tea and coffee. Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence regarding, wellness prevention about tea, coffee, things, or is there any harm?
Yeah, the benefit in surrounding these drinks is likely, if you benefit from it, you're probably choosing tea or coffee over some other type of drink which may have sugar or some other content in it, which is not as good for you. I don't think there's any direct evidence that we're seeing that we're actually recommending that, drink one glass of green tea or drink a cup of coffee or something like that.
Things like meditation, mindfulness, Tai Chi, focus. And I know Jackie is here, assuming Jackie wasn't here. What would you say? Would you prescribe it to people that it is a wellness technique?
Yeah, I think so. And it takes some a dedicated individual who has goals and some commitment to do things like, learn mindfulness and practice mindfulness. It takes effort, right? And they need to be in that level where they're ready to make that change. For the right individual, I do recommend things like mindfulness and things like Tai Chi. We do know that it helps with balance, prevents falls, and is particularly good for individuals with osteoporosis.
Right. Great. So I'll just check. There's one question from Nancy Marshall. Nancy, your question is, can you comment on osteoarthritis? And I know we have gone overboard for time. So, can you comment on osteoarthritis that is resulting in chronic pain and making it difficult to exercise? So I'm assuming the question, Nancy, there you are. Go ahead, ask away. Oh, we can't hear you because I think your microphone is off.
Okay. Maybe it could be a topic for a future Zoom.
Okay.
Session,
yes.
Because I think there's a lot about osteoarthritis and pain management and just understanding what's happening to your body when parts, your feet don't work the way they used to. So
okay, good. So we have three topics that we have heard. One is sleep, and we will source a speaker on that. We haven't. Arthritis is another one. And the third suggestion that has come up is about spiritual care. How does spiritual care interact with healthcare and those kind of things? So we'll look at all of those. Vang, I'll thank you. This has been very informative. You have really jump-started, I think, in a lot of people's mind how to deal with things. So thank you. Thank you for taking the time, the effort, and thank you for attending, folks. And we'll be back April, the third Wednesday in April, as usual. Stay tuned for the topic because we haven't finalized it. Otherwise, we would have announced it tonight. Take care.
Thank you, everyone.